Life, culture, and current events from a biblical perspective. 2020 on Vision.
Coming out of the Australia Day weekend, I hope you had a fabulous long weekend this past weekend. Well, here we are in the middle of the week now, and our sights turn to this coming Sunday, the 2nd of February. It's National Christian Heritage Sunday. What's so special about that, you ask? Well, it marks the day that the gospel of Jesus Christ arrived on Australian shores. Australia's first Christian minister, the Reverend Richard Johnson, arrived on the First Fleet on the 26th of January back in 1788. Well, then on the 3rd of February, 1 week after the arrival, Reverend Richard Johnson held the first Christian church service in Australia. So, the day is celebrated on the first Sunday in February each year. As Australia's first chaplain, Reverend Johnson spent 12 years in Australia, 1788 to 1800, with several roles as a military and prison chaplain, parish priest, missionary to the indigenous community, and as a husband, a father, and provider during the early years of food deprivation. Well, we're going to talk about that, and we'll be talking about the significance of what it means to our nation that that first service was held on Australian soil. And so, very shortly, we'll open our talkback lines. You can let us know your impressions. It might even be a surprise to you that there is such a celebration that celebrates the very first church service on Australian soil. We'll open our talkback lines shortly, but our special guest through this coming hour, Dr. Graham McLennan, who's founder of Christian History Research, and he helped initiate National Christian Heritage Sunday. He also formed the National Alliance of Christian Leaders, and joining us to talk through the significance of that very first church service, Graham McLennan, a special welcome along to 2020.
Well, Graham, good morning, Neil.
Great to have you on the program, and always love to get your impressions about the significance of these sorts of historical events in our history. We are going to be talking about the significance. Let's talk about that first. I mean, we had a church service. Everyone was there. And it's significant then, and it is significant for us today because it's so historic. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's a tremendous opportunity to understand one of the reasons why the British colony was set up in Australia, and that was to transform the southern hemisphere to a Christian civilization. And that is stated many times, even in the British Parliament, for instance, in 1827, Torrens stated that, that he wanted the Christian gospel to cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. So that was in about 1827. So that was later on, of course. But I think one of the similarities that particularly indigenous people would like to know about is that the coming of the light in the Torres Strait Islands in 1871 was a tremendous opportunity, and it stopped the warring islanders and so on, and it brought peace. And so they celebrate that from 1871 on July the 1st. And it's because the London Missionary Society people came from New Caledonia over there. And that's what happened. And we would have hoped that that could have occurred here in Australia in 1788 with Richard Johnson. And he had a dream, particularly with John Newton and William Wilberforce, when they persuaded William Pitt, the Prime Minister, to have a chaplain set apart to preach the gospel to the convicts and the soldiers and to the indigenous people in Australia. So he brought out with him 4,000 pieces of literature. There is a myth about an urban myth that they brought one Bible out. That's not true. He brought indeed 4,000 copies of Christian literature, including Bibles, 400 New Testaments, things like that. It was really a tremendous opportunity to proclaim the gospel in the South Seas. In actual fact, if I say, Neil, that the 34 Pacific nations are all predominantly Christian. And that is because the Brits came out with the gospel into the Pacific through firstly Magellan, then the Quiros, then Cook, discovering the islands here. And then they then used the gospel to go into these countries, particularly in the Pacific. And so that's why they're predominantly Christian to this day.
Well, it is an amazing fact when you point to that, because oftentimes we'll talk about the growth of even Christian media as as Vision Radio has sort of overflowed the shores of Australia and into those South Pacific islands, and there is a significant Christian population. In fact, some of those island nations, they'd consider themselves Christian nations, and it goes back to that arrival of the First Fleet. It goes back to the arrival of Richard Johnson, the first chaplain, and he often, Graham, and I'll get your impression here, he often doesn't get the good rap that he deserves. He sometimes is overlooked as if he was somehow rather accidentally on the boat. But no, he was an integral part of the whole team.
Yeah, that's true. You know, it's certainly true about the missionaries such as John Williams, who gave up his life for the gospel. And I go to Vanuatu a lot, and we've set up, UCB Asia Pacific set up Christian stations in Vanuatu and one on Tanna. Well, John Williams was martyred in Eromango, which is the island just to the north of where we set up a station there in Samaria in southeast Tanna. But, you know, even groups like YWAM, they're a tremendous missionary organisation. They're now the largest, and they've got so many bases in Australia going out. You've got HCJB, who's reached beyond, is up near Carnarvon up there, northwest shelf of Australia. And certainly it's broadcasting into Asia and so on too. So we are as well. Of course, he's at UCB Asia Pacific in Nepal. There's other opportunities like in Myanmar and so on, and even Cambodia, but certainly in Timor-Leste where we're preaching the gospel there in various stations. So the South Australia actually was set up to be a Christian nation. And there were many people like Angus, George Fife Angus, who proclaimed the gospel there. And he was credited with distributing millions of pieces of literature in those days, and when from 1838 onwards, where South Australia was settled. So they believed it was a nation to be proclaiming the gospel. And certainly the London Missionary Society that went to the Torres Strait, they had published a book in 1895 of the 100 years of spreading the gospel throughout Asia Pacific, but particularly Australasia and Pacific. And on it, they had rays on the front book. They had pictures of Australia, Tasmania, New Zealand, with rays radiating out to Africa, to India, to all of Asia and the Pacific Islands. And it's interesting that some of these countries are, as I said before, predominantly Christian now.
It's exciting, in fact, when we talk about the First Fleet, because so much of the history is about the British dumping convicts in Australia, and then you've got the whole controversy around Invasion Day. And it's so refreshing, Graham, to be able to hear a dimension that there was a motivation that was mixed in with the First Fleet, which goes way, way beyond any of those things, and that is to bring the gospel, this light of God, to the South Pacific, to the Southern Hemisphere. That's such a powerful thing.
It is. Truly it is. Actually, I'd like to quote, if you don't mind, from some official records, but John Newton, of course, he is the author of Amazing Grace, exalted Johnson, saying, "The seed you sow in the settlement may be sown for future generations, and I be... and be transported, transplanted in times far and wide. And I please myself with the hope that Port Jackson may be the spot from whence light may hence spread in all directions." Now, one of Johnson's successor, his next successor, was Samuel Marsden, and he said this: "It is my opinion that God will ere long visit New South Wales with his heavenly grace. Out of these stones he will raise up children under Abraham. There's not been shaking yet among the dry bones, but the Son of Man is commanded to prophesy, and I hope that by and by the Lord will command the wind to blow up and stir us up, thy strength, and come among us." And so Marsden's vision for Australia included not only the evangelisation of the Aborigines and the colonists, but the nations of the South Seas and beyond. And he saw a divine plan in all these human affairs. And in 1814, in a sermon given after the first of seven voyages to New Zealand, Marsden reminded his listeners that while the decision to found a penal settlement at Botany Bay was motivated by expediency, God, who governed the world, had another strategy in mind: the evangelisation of the heathen nations of the South Seas. Marsden believed that God's plan was to equip Australia for the job of missionary evangelism of the surrounding nations. This has resulted, as I said before, in all the nations of the Pacific now having Christianity as their major faith.
Graham, interesting, isn't it, to reflect on the success of what happened with the chaplain, Richard Johnson, and saying all these South Pacific nations become Christian when the gospel comes to them. But it's not just a blip on the radar for Australia too, because when we say, was that successful, sending a chaplain on the First Fleet, we've got to say, yes, it was, because just look around us. Go to any country town around the country, and you'll find three or four churches. They're old churches. They've been there a long time. And what it is a demonstration, a testament to the success of what Richard Johnson did when he brought the gospel on the First Fleet.
Yep, certainly is. And I just actually like to tell a story about an Aboriginal man. And Johnson raised for a short time, for a couple of years, a girl, an Aboriginal girl, Gabaroo, and particularly his wife, Mary. He raised her, and her other name was Bruong. But it's interesting because she went back to her tribal ways, and she married after Bennelong. We've all heard of Bennelong, because Bennelong Point is where the opera house is, and Bennelong was a famous Aboriginal man after settlement. And certainly his former wife, who died, and her name is Barangaroo, which, of course, is where, in round Darling Harbour, the huge amount of development is. So on either side of the harbour bridge, you've got Bennelong and Barangaroo. But he later, after Barangaroo died, married Bruong, who'd been raised by the Johnsons. And it's interesting because they had a child in 1803, and that child was named Dicky, D-O-C-K-E-Y. And so there's Bennelong's grandson. So he became Australia's first evangelist. He became later a Christian and became Australia's first Indigenous Christian. And so the Indigenous people, who are predominantly more Christian, actually, than the remainder of Australia, in fact, had their own evangelists going amongst their own people from the early 1820s, after he became a Christian in his later youth. So there's lots of stories I could tell about what's happened within that type of community, but certainly within the white community, there are revivals that went on right throughout Australia. After the ship Duff came to us to the Pacific in late 1790s, that came into the Pacific, and that they put people off at Tahiti, particularly people there, and then they faced death, actually, and some of them came to the colony just a few years later, the Shelleys and the Hassels and others, and they proclaimed the gospel to all the colonies that had been established in, like, New South Wales, Van Diemen's Land, and then later at Port Phillip, where John Pascoe Faulkner wanted this Christian civilizations to commence there with John Bettman and others. So actually, John Bettman and Norman had the first Christian service there. So there is constantly a Christian presence, and tragically, disease. I think the real invasion was of European disease, like smallpox, which killed a lot of people. And I know John Harris has written a history of the Aboriginal people with Christianity, and that's a classic book. And it calls it the story of hope, but I really call it the story of sadness and tragedy. And it's very sad to see that these people who became Christians, a lot of them then died from European-introduced diseases. So
and that I book really you're talking about by John Harris is called One Blood. And as I understand it, you can get a download of that when you go onto the chr.org.au website, Christian Research Institute.
Visions 2020 with Neil Johnson. A biblical perspective on life, culture and current events.
Well, I think we're just pausing to remember and reflect on the significance of that very first church service on Australian soil, happened a week after the First Fleet arrived on our shores. And of course, it's all so controversial. Is this part of the invasion of Australia? And was it just the British dropping off their convicts onto our soil and getting rid of them? Was there some sort of a plot involved? Well, let's talk about this other dimension that we're talking about with that very first church service on Australian soil, because all along the plan was that Australia would be a starting point for the evangelization of the South Pacific. a point where there would be prison reform that would happen because convicts were coming to Australia. And so there was a chaplain on board the First Fleet, and he was third in charge. His name was Richard Johnson. Let's come back to the very first church service held on our soil. And our special guest, Dr. Graham McLennan, is with us. And he helped initiate the National Christian Heritage Sunday. Graham, it would have been a significant day. Everybody was to be there. No exceptions.
That's right. That's right. Yes. And if I could read from the actual account of it, of the actual service, it was held on a grassy hill under a tree. The first service conducted by the chaplain on Australian soil was an impressive occasion and has often been described, and careful preparations were made, the convicts being ordered to appear as clean as circumstances will admit, and no man to be absent on any account whatsoever. The guard was to be changed earlier than usual so as to give those who had been relieved time to cleanse themselves before church, and the church drum was to beat at 10 o'clock sharp. This service took place on the 3rd of February, 1788. The fleet had been in Sydney Cove the previous Sunday, the 27th of January, but no service was held until some semblance of order had been created on shore. Johnson would no doubt have been impressed by the special nature of this occasion and would have chosen his text and prepared his sermon with some care. The content of the sermon has not survived, but the text was Psalm 116, verse 12, "What shall I render unto the Lord for all his benefits towards me?" So to repeat that, "What shall I render unto the Lord for all his benefits towards me?" This verse is set in a context which was particularly appropriate for the occasion, as it reflects the experience of someone who has undergone severe and repeated sufferings, but has survived to give thanks to God for his safe deliverance. Johnson would very likely have drawn his congregation's attention to the way in which the experience of those who had arrived in the First Fleet was parallel to the experience of the psalmist, and then gone on to urge them to respond to God's benefits in the way suggested by verse 13. "I will take the cup of salvation and call upon the name of the Lord." The sense of relief and gratitude of having finally landed in an area that at least looked comparatively promising would thus have given the chaplain the opportunity to speak to the situation of both convicts and soldiers in a meaningful way, and this would recount for the manner in which the congregation responded. "The service was well received. Tench wrote," that's Captain Tench, "wrote that the behaviour of both the troops and convicts was equally regular and attentive." It was a miraculous fleet arrival, really, that there only just a couple died on that, whereas later voyages, actually, which were some of the ships were owned by slave traders, but, and that's how they treated them, just like slaves.
That's right. Convicts, and there's a big story around that, because the Christian dimensions of how they governed the actual voyage preserved the life of those who were on board. Let's come back to that church service, though, Graham. And great to be able to hear an account of what might have happened on that day. But let's put ourselves on that green grassy hill. And just to imagine what that might have been like, because I noted that you mentioned that, you know, the observation was that everybody was attentive. And there could be an assumption that because everyone was a convict, or lots of people were convicts, so some of those were obviously a part of the crew and the soldiers who were there.
Yep.
But but there was a reverence for the occasion, and people were paying attention because they recognised something significant had happened. They'd got there safely.
Yep, they did. And because it was just like going to Mars, or, you know, going to the moon, the first time that a fleet like that had ever gone such distance in recorded history. In actual fact, there are other recorded miracles as far as mariners are concerned. Even Captain Bligh, who rowed a boat, well, he prayed before he left Tahiti, the shores of Tahiti, and he ended up in Indonesia just rowing with his few of his men. So there's been a tremendous amount of miraculous things occurring, I think, with the sovereignty of God operating in the settlement of Australia, because by a Christian country, the thing is that the Muslims try to come down, the Hindu Buddhists try to come down, the Chinese try to come down, but it's because of their religious beliefs that has stopped them going past the line called which is the Treaty of Zaragoza, and also just above Australia, where they just felt fear, and they thought there were demons down here and kingdom of women and death awaited them, and so on. And so there is this line that they wouldn't come past. And so God protected, I believe, a nation with all its faults, coming to Australia with the gospel of Jesus Christ.
I know there are a lot of people who try to argue today that Australia doesn't have Christian foundations. Well, of course, this goes completely against that and affirms the Christian presence and the intention that happened right from the arrival of the First Fleet. And so we talk about reverence of the occasion, and everyone was paying attention there. Everyone had to be there. You know, you had to be there. So if you or I were there and we were convicts, well, we'd have had to clean ourselves up, you know. Hey, McLennan, you haven't shaved, you know. You'd have to have a shave and you'd be clean, and you're arriving there for church. And you're there because you have to be there. But what marks that, the fact that everyone was there, was that this was intended to be a Christian stake in the ground. And I wonder if you've got any reflection on that.
Well, Governor Phillips' instructions said exactly that, that it was going to be a Christian colony, that the due observance of Christian services would take place and all that sort of thing, that they weren't to live as retrobates and so on. And so they're trying to reform them all the time. And just like today, we need national transformation. They just didn't need it, the convicts, but we do need it now, because, I mean, with abortion and all the things going on, even in today's papers, we see the Margaret Court being persecuted and so on. So we just see a need for a national transformation, just as they wanted a new civilization starting here that was Christian. So, certainly in Governor Phillips' instructions, that was the case.
And when we talk about national transformation, I mean, there is a sense, isn't there, when we can identify that arrival of the gospel on Australian soil, the intention was national transformation. That included Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, that they would actually have access to this gospel, which is about freedom, which, you know, and of course, as you mentioned, the disease and those sorts of things came and muddied the waters somewhat. However, the national transformation had begun at that point, and it has continued. There's an assumption, isn't there, today, that somehow or other there's a pause on that national transformation, that somehow the job finished a while ago, and now we're going to pieces with a sort of a humanistic direction. But of course, the national transformation in our own minds has to continue.
My word. Yep. So Karl Marx, we're influenced by cultural Marxism a lot, and postmodernism, existentialism, and relativism, all these big isms. But he said, Karl Marx, that people who don't know their history can be easily persuaded, and we are being easily persuaded in schools, universities, and we keep getting this stuff shoved down our throats. But I'd just like to share about what happened on a couple of the ships that came out with the convict ships with the people on board. And that was on the Earl Grey and the Theresa, and that this was in the 1830s, early 1840s, before transportation stopped. And on those ships, revival took place. They actually took place on these ships, and there was a Colin Browning, the surgeon, who got permission from the Admiralty to teach them to read. And so when he got on board, he gave them a big pep talk and said, when you come to this nation, you can have a transformation in your lives. You can go from your past to a future that's ahead of you. If you behave yourself, you will be granted land. You can have a little home and so on. And
Graham, I need to cut in here because we're about to go to news, but let's hold this thought that revival was breaking out on board the ships of the First Fleet, and those convicts were offered the opportunity for transformed lives, bring a new change, a new leaf, a new page in their lives. We'll continue our conversation all about the what is called National Christian Heritage Sunday, being celebrated this coming Sunday. There were revivals breaking out on board the ships. Just to pick up from where we were before the news, what were your thoughts on those revivals?
Well, there are revivals that happened in later on in the 30s and 40s that are recorded in a book which is on that website, chr.org.au, called England's Exiles. And it's on the front page, bottom right-hand side, and it's a book you can look through to verify all these facts. But it's interesting because Colin Browning, who is a surgeon on board these ships, he talked to the Admiralty and he said they got 3.25 months at least at sea. They're just sitting there idle. We need to teach them to read and write and to help them understand what the gospel is. So what he did was he gave him a big pep talk, actually. He said, you know, you can leave your past behind, you can have a future in this new nation, and you can be Christians, and God will look after you and help you and prosper you in a lot of ways. And that's what happened with many of them. And so they decided to give it a go. And what happened is some of the people did understand English, and not like some Aussies, but anyway, to read and write and to be literate and so on. So he taught them to read and write. And what he did, those that could read and write, he put them in charge of groups. And then what happened then was that each of those books that he that were read were parts of Scripture. And so by the end of the journey, they could read and memorize many parts of the Scriptures. And because of that, some became Christians earlier within the first month or so. It was a bit hard in the first month, but after about the first month on board the ship, because they wanted something to occupy themselves. They didn't mind reading the Scriptures. And so they did that, and they had competitions on learning verses, and they used to go up and repeat the 23rd Psalm and the other Scriptures. And but what happened was some of them became Christians, and some of them became some of the worst of them really became deeply committed in their faith, and they helped others become Christians. And by the time they reached Port Jackson, many of them were Christians. And so there is a story of the revivals that took place on particularly Teresa and Earl Grey. So that's recorded on chr.org.au and the book of England's Exiles. So, but what also happened was that Johnson introduced education to the colonists and to the soldiers and settlers, and also educated Aboriginal people. And the person who topped the first class was an Aboriginal girl, actually. So that's interesting as well. But yes.
And what I was about to say is interesting when you talk about Johnson introducing the first education and the schooling. And this was not because he thought that was a good idea. It was because that was his job. He was going to introduce the schools because they were going to be learning from basically what we'd call a curriculum. And the curriculum was centered on the Bible in those days. So,
yes.
So it was just something that he was commissioned to do. This was his job, was to start the schooling. It wasn't anybody else's job. There was no Department of Education already in place. It was Johnson. It was his responsibility.
Yeah, that's true. And as a result of that, you know, the we know about the lads and lasses, they were called. And so there are reports in, say, the 1820s, and one I can read from Peter Cunningham, a senior naval surgeon.
As a Graham, these are called currency lads and lasses. In other words, this is the first generation that the convicts giving birth to their children, and this demonstrates what happened when these children are exposed to the education and schooling system set up by Johnson. So sorry to interrupt you there, just for listeners who might not know what currency lads and lasses are.
So that is the new generation, and Cunningham says this about them. They are little tainted with the vices so prominent among their parents. Drunkenness is almost unknown with them, and honesty proverbial. A few of them that have been convicted having acted under the bad auspices of their parents and relatives.
So another
quote I love to read is that by Sir William Burton, who's a Supreme Court judge in Sydney, and this was recorded in 1833, and how impressed he was with the law-abiding nature of these native-born kids. He wrote, "There was not one of them ever tried before the writer for any of those atrocious crimes which are attributed to their country, but belong only to the convict class. Nor did he know any person born in the colony being tried or even charged with either the offence of rape or any other licentious crime, nor has he ever found any offence committed by then any of them, such as to call upon him to pronounce sentence of death. And no such sentence has ever been passed with his knowledge or any crime committed with such a degree of violence to justify it." So they were totally different. They were totally transformed because they grew up under Christians and the gospel.
And that is so powerful to reflect on, isn't it? Because, you know, we talk about the transforming effect of the Bible, of the gospel, the good news message of Christ. And here we have it in our own history. a demonstration in the currency, lads and lasses, that this is the difference that a education that is based in Christian things actually does. It transforms lives. And as you say, those children, they didn't take on the vices of their parents. In fact, they had a wonderful reputation. And some people might be saying, Graham, and just take us a little bit off track here, about what sort of flavour of Christianity this might have been. And we know that Richard Johnson was a minister in the Church of England, but heavily influenced by the Methodism of John Wesley. Yes. And so,
my word.
And so for people who want to get an idea about what the very first chaplain, what shaped him, you can look at some of those influences, and they have very powerful influences on him.
They certainly are. Yeah, they certainly are. And so we grew up with the foundation of a Christian base here, even though the circumstances were shocking. And so that there was a seed placed here, and many people throughout Australia have given their lives to that seed that is placed here. And they've been missionaries right throughout the world, come from Australia and New Zealand. Because New Zealand was established through Australia. And in actual fact, New South Wales Legislative Council governed New Zealand in its early days. And the people who founded South Australia said, we need to go to New Zealand, and found that as well. So you had Sir John Gray and others who were involved in South Australia, who founded a Christian colony there, go to New Zealand and govern over there as well. So it's had huge implications and a tremendous growth of Christian civilization throughout this Southern Hemisphere. Austral, by the way, means southern, and so southern is like in Australasia and other places. It means southern continent, but basically Australia dello Spirito, which is with an I in it, after the Habsburgs, the Austrians, with Prince Philip III naming it with the Kyros and the South Lands and so on. So we're just prophetically just blessed.
We are. But look, it wasn't an easy road in those early days. Let's just reflect for a few moments on some of the challenges that Chaplain Richard Johnson faced. I mean, he held so much responsibility. He was third in charge on the First Fleet. And so he was an officer. He was you know, charged with doing a whole bunch of things. He had a job description, military chaplain, parish priest, missionary. You mentioned too, husband and farmer. I mean, the idea of farmer, I mean, he's actually credited with saving the colony at one point because he had some farming skills.
That's right, that's right. And that's tremendous. But just to mention too that about 1792, he'd performed 226 baptisms, 220 marriages, and 854 burials. But he was the first to produce an orchard in Australia, and his garden in Bridge Street, and that's very near the quay, very close to the quay, 1790, produced nearly 1,000 cucumbers as well as other fruit and veggies. So he's a vegetable farmer. He provided that during the early times of starvation in the colony, deprivation. And he was given a 100-acre farm granted to him called Canterbury Vale, which is now Canterbury, the suburb of Canterbury. You know, Canterbury Bulldogs and so on. The suburb now named after Canterbury Vale. But by 1795, he had cropped 38 acres of wheat. He's one of the first wheat farmers in Australia, and that yielded 16 to 18 bushels per acre. So all you farmers out there, he's one of the first farmers in Australia. With wheat farmers, he's certainly the first orchardist. I live in an orcharding area of Orange. He became Australia's first wheat farmer, and by 1800, the year he left, he had grown an acre of orange trees, nectarines, peaches and apricots, as well as 2-acre vineyard, and stocked 150 sheep plus some cattle and horses. So Captain Tench recorded that he was the best farmer in the colony. So he was the best farmer in the colony. Yes. He helped towards stopping the starvation and deprivation that occurred in the early days.
And you know, when you reflect on Christian leaders, so many pastors, priests, they do have to be a jack of all trades. And you've got to turn your attention to an awful lot of things. And really, at the beginning of the colony, there was an awful lot of responsibility that he held. And not without opposition too, because while we're talking about everybody being present there for the very first church service, there were obviously, some contentious things and tensions that had developed, and there were challenges there, and there was some resistance to actually erecting the first church on Australian soil. It wasn't state built. In fact, as far as I am, I'm aware that Richard Johnson financed the project himself. What's your understanding of the story of the very first church that was built?
Well, it was built in 1793. In actual fact, we had the bicentenary of Christian schooling because it was really the first church and was built to as a school as well in 1793. So the bicentenary of that was in 1993. So we had a number of people gathered there, lots of schools, Christian schools, the Scots Band had their bagpipes and other schools and so on. So it was a time to remember that. But he really was opposed by Grose, who followed Governor Phillip, and there was a division between the Wesleyan Methodist, Evangelical Anglicans, and the High Church Anglicans, and so there was some division there, and that created a problem with Grose and others, and even Grose's son was became a clergyman. So there's some tensions there, as you said, but the convicts didn't like Hunter imposing the fact that it is compulsory to have church service and attend it. So 5 years later, in 1798, the convicts burned it down. Some convicts burned it down. So there was that friction, but it also was the first school, that church. So we celebrated the bicentenary of it in 1993. So that was great.
You've got a great memory for those dates. Hey, but this is really an interesting point, isn't it? That it's not always been an easy road in establishing the Christian church in Australia. And when you hearken back to the very first chaplain who fought to have a church built, then in some sort of, digging his heels in, said, well, okay, well, if the government at the day can't support that, I'm going to build it myself. So he did, and there were tensions there. And as you say, it was eventually burned to the ground by people who were opposing the idea of needing to attend church, even though that was bringing those wonderful benefits to the children of the colony. So it's never been an easy road, building and establishing the Christian church in Australia, and the journey's not over yet, Graham.
No, it's certainly not. Johnson actually used to get up at 4 o'clock and row to Parramatta to preach and perform numerous funerals and marriages and baptisms. I mentioned the number that he did by 1792. So he's a remarkable man. Matter of fact, he suffered a fair bit and really had to return to England. But 12 years of hard work, hard slog. He was a real pioneer. He's a brave man. His wife was a wonderful woman. There's not much known about Mary, his wife. She only wrote one letter back, but Johnson certainly wrote a lot. And those essays or letters are recorded in chr.org.au, actually. And so we need to actually talk about the National Christian Heritage Sunday being on next Sunday, this Sunday. And it's a lot of that material that we talk about is on the website nchs.net.au. So that's nchs.net.au. And there's a fair bit on how to participate, have something during your service, research things in your own area about the Christian faith. And there's some resources there, including a hymn about Richard Johnson before he left by John Newton. And so there's some links and some other things there. But certainly you've got a lot of guidance on the National Christian Heritage website, nchs.org.net.au, as well as chr.org.au. So would you like me to read John Newton's
hymn? Let's get the essence of that hymn, because this is very important, because when listeners will recognise John Newton as the one who wrote perhaps what is one of the best known hymns of all time, Amazing Grace, and that he was a part of that group that gave their endorsement, or their put their imprimatur on Richard Johnson as the man to bring the gospel message to the Pacific, to the South. And so he wrote a hymn. And what are the words? Read us some of those words,
well,
Graham.
Yeah. Well, by the way, the others like John Newton referred to him as the Apostle of the South Seas. Actually,
John, the Apostle of the South Seas, yes.
Yeah, Richard Johnson. So here it is, and the Lord who sends thee hence will be thine aid. In vain at thee the lion danger roars. His arm and love shall keep thee undismayed. On tempest-tossed seas and savage shores, go bear the Saviour's name to lands unknown. Tell to the southern world this wondrous grace, and energy divine thy word shall own, and draw their untaught hearts to seek his face. Many in quest of gold or empty fame would compass earth or venture near the poles, but how much nobler thy reward and aim to spread his praise and win immortal souls.
Well, it just demonstrates, doesn't it, that that Richard Johnson was a missionary to Australia. He was on a great co-mission, doing the mission with God, bringing the gospel to the southern region, the southern Great Southland, as it had been known. But so this missionary endeavour, this is a powerful way to think about the very first Christian leader in Australia, a powerful way to think about the things that he was called to do, because even as you say, with John Newton writing a hymn like that, that was almost like, here's a job description for you too, Richard Johnson.
Yeah, it certainly was. Yep.
Okay, so this coming Sunday, churches will be some will pause and will reflect on that. It is the very day that we would celebrate National Christian Heritage Sunday. You said there's some resources on the nchs.net.au website. What do you think of with churches taking a few moments to just pause and say, you know, it actually is a significant Sunday, National Christian Heritage Sunday. What's your encouragement to people listening to us today? Perhaps get something up this weekend in their church.
Yeah, well, they can look at the website in the participate page, and there's a 5-minute spiel on the whole idea of celebrating our Christian heritage and what we've done in our own localities and the localised and decentralised that don't have it in a special place particularly, but in our churches. And so there is a short service and prayers and guidance there. But there's also resources. People can... there's huge number of resources that are in the chr.org.au list, but certainly there's some here in the home pages of the resources of the nchs.net.au, like an account of the first Christian service, which I read out, Richard Johnson's Bible. You can have a look at that. There's the letters of Richard Johnson. There's a video that I've produced about the Richard Johnson and Johnson Square. That's for 4 minutes, addressed to the inhabitants of the colonies by Richard Johnson, which is pretty heavy, really. It's about a 97-page little booklet that he wrote to the colonies of New South Wales after he departed, and is helped by Newton and others to send it back for them to read. How Richard Johnson felt about coming to Australia, accepting this position, and so on. So I've also given a speech based on some of this material to before the governor in New South Wales at Richard Johnson Square, so a few years ago. So there's plenty of material there on Richard Johnson, on Marsden, on plenty of the explorers and governors and so on in Southland of the Holy Spirit, which was published in 1993 at the bicentenary of the Christian schooling in Australia. And so there's lots of things about explorers such as Matthew Flinders, Blackstone, Wentworth and Lawson, Charles Sturt, Edwin Eyre, George Grey and others, and even about Arthur Phillip and John Hunter and Lachlan Macquarie and so on, Governor Gibson. Actually, I could talk about Days of Prayer. So there's stacks of things on those websites with Richard Burke and others as another governor there. So they're pioneers, John Flynn, Carolyn Chisholm, Elizabeth MacArthur, so on, John Ridley, Hugh, Victor McKay. There's stacks of links to other websites too that talk about William Holland, the guy that started the Holden industry down in South Australia. So there's plenty of, there's huge amounts of material, including books and so on. On the website.
And Graham McLennan, some honour to you here, because only not that long ago, count it back a decade, and people would have not found it easy to gather these sorts of resources to actually bring meaningfulness even into their local church or in their own understanding of our Christian history. But as the one who is the founder of the Christian History Research Institute and the chr.org.au website, you've created a wonderful capacity for people to actually get the information they need when they need it. And then being part of the initiation of the National Christian Heritage Sunday, and it'll be celebrated this coming Sunday. Years ago, people wouldn't have been able to get the detail, but now it's as easy as going to a website, nchs.net.au, utilizing the technology, making it available for people. And so our conversation today, I guess, about letting people know that that's the resource that's there, and the encouragement to take advantage of that resource and use it to its best, the best way that it can be used to draw attention for congregations. It's just great to get these insights, Graham McLennan, and just pointing, this Sunday, the 2nd of February, is National Christian Heritage Sunday. The website is nchs.net.au. Graham McLennan, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts with us today on 2020.
It's a pleasure, Neil.
Thanks for taking time to listen to this audio on demand from Vision Christian Media. To find out more about us, go to vision.org.au.